Wild, you never see a positive drug story on the news, do you? You ever seen one? Isn't that weird? Don't you think that's strange? I mean, the news is supposed to be objective. Isn't it supposed to be the news? But every drug story is negative? Well, hold it. I've had some killer times on drugs. I'm not promoting it, but I'm not denying it. Let's hear the whole fucking story. Same LSD story every time. We've all heard it. Young man on acid, thought he could fly, jumped out of a building. What a tragedy. What a... Don't go blaming acid on this guy. Hey, hey, hey. If he thought he could fly, let him take off from the ground and check it out first. He's an idiot. He's dead. Good. You don't see ducks lined up to catch elevators to fly north, do you? No, they fly from the ground. The guy was a moron. He's dead. Good. No tragedy. You mean there's one less idiot in the world? Whew, how am I going to sleep through the night? Why so down, Bill? We're missing a moron. We're missing a moron. I mean, I'm not trying to be cold or cruel or, you know, but goddamn, let's hear the whole story. Wouldn't you like to see a positive LSD story on the news to hear what it's all about, perhaps? Wouldn't that be interesting just once? Today, a young man on acid realized that all matter is merely energy condensed to a slow vibration, that we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. There's no such thing as death. Life is only a dream, and we're the imagination of ourselves. Here's Tom with the weather. Wow. Did you see the news? Something about how we're God's perfect and holy thoughts, and we live in His mind, and there's no reason to suffer or lack, ever. I thought it was sort of newsworthy.
Must remember too experience is safe. At the very worst, you will end up the same person who entered this experience. All of the dangers which you have feared are unnecessary productions of your own mind. Whether you experience heaven or hell, remember that it is your mind which creates them. Avoid grasping the one or fleeing the other. You must maintain faith and trust in the potentiality of your own nervous system and the billion-year-old life process. With your ego left behind you, your brain can't go wrong. Try to keep the memory of a revered teacher or a trusted friend whose name can serve as guide and protection. Trust your divinity. Trust your brain. Trust your traveling companions. Whenever in doubt, turn off your mind. Relax. Float downstream.
And this is Cognitive Liberty here on WHRW every Thursday at between 6:30 and 7. Hope you're enjoying the mix. This is Will here with
Drazilia.
Drazilia?
That's right.
How many times have you tripped Drazilia?
Oh, I don't know. Do you want like a number or a lot?
Well, why don't you, give me an estimation, a number.
I don't know, 45.
And that's with what?
Oh, yeah, well, I guess you have to define tripping. Go on,
Will. Did you trip with the assistance of any plants? The hallucinogenic plants, or did you trip with music?
You mean nature's friends,
yeah.
or man-made friends, or everybody's friends?
Yeah, whichever.
Well, I'd have to go back and recalculate.
Okay.
Because that was just for, like, the nature's friends.
Nature's friends. So you said, what'd you say?
45?
45.
I don't know. Didn't we come up with that figure at the coffee shop I was trying to work out.
And so that's primarily with psilocybin?
Primarily.
So 45 represents psilocybin.
You're asking someone that's had a substantial number of trips. I think I'd have to go back and have some time to think about these things.
What about, like, ballpark? Just give me, a rough idea. Has it been 50% psilocybin? And
oh, no, majority.
Majority psilocybin. And then a mixture of what other things?
Ayahuasca?
That's DMT.
That's DMT.
Uh-huh.
No.
You've never used that?
No.
Okay, what about LSD?
No.
Never?
No.
Only nature's friends?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh, okay. So what, I mean, besides psilocybin, what is there?
Well, there are other organic compounds, organic chemicals, and, say, philosopher's stone truffles, which don't contain psilocybin, I don't think. They may be a sister to psilocybin.
Okay.
And other things.
This is cognitive liberty. Can you explain to me
what cognitive liberty is?
Or what does it mean to you?
Cognitive liberty, just, it's freedom as we know it. It's the reason why you want to participate in this drama. Novelty. I don't know, freedom of expression.
Freedom of thought.
Just, like, no restrictions on your growth.
Do you think that psychedelic research in, like, an academic environment is important?
Sure, and increasingly prominent institutions of higher learning in America are jumping on the train. Like, we talked about a show or two ago with UCLA, Harbor Medical Center, and Harvard.
Harvard has a long history, right?
That was where
Dr. Leary taught.
Right.
Yeah.
And Ralph Metzner.
Do you think that psychedelic research is more important to, like, the medical community for understanding conditions like maybe schizophrenia? Or do you think psychedelic research is more important to the individual that trips?
Well, I think they're beneficial. Like, I think they're they're beneficial in just full stop, all around. And I think the only way, like, they're slowly coming back into our society, being acceptable. And I think any way this is done is positive. So, I mean, currently they're only testing these things on terminally ill cancer patients, which is, like, you know, probably, I don't know how many more years it'll be until they're, you know, you can test it on just normal patients and get an FDA-approved study. But I don't know. Of course. That's the whole reason for doing this show, that independent, private experimentation with these things could be beneficial in some way or another. I mean, the University of Hawaii, in fact, you can find this on the Multidisciplinary Approach to Psychedelic Studies website.
That's MAPS.org?
MAPS.org. They're just wrapping up this, like, year or two long survey, and a lot of their professors were on board on this one, and just accumulating all kinds of beneficial psychedelic experiences, and what you learned, like what someone learned about politics or medicine or their child, just everything. And they're making this big compilation. I don't know what they're going to do with it. It'll be interesting to see what it is, because it's, you know, psychologists, doctors, you know, poli-sci professors and everything.
How long has that been going on?
I think about a year or two.
There's a lot of people that, if you read the psychedelic literature, there's, you know, people talk about being in contact with dead ancestors or God or gods or goddesses or the collective unconscious or spiritual guides, things like that. Like, can this be dismissed simply as some kind of drug-induced dream fantasy state? Or do you think that these plants, these chemicals, open up doors to magical communication channels?
Well, it depends on, like, which way you're looking at it. I don't think that there is, like, when people say paranormal or magic, like, maybe because I don't know, the scientist in me won't allow me to think like that, but I don't think there's a need to think of it as, like, somehow separate from, like, something chemical going on in a certain location in your brain. I mean, you call it magic, magical doors, and it really could be, like, the serotonin receptor, like, hatching on to, or, like, you know, accepting something else, which isn't serotonin, but something else that's going to turn the key a little further, and maybe, I don't know, what's stored within us genetically deep down inside. I mean, maybe, and who knows, and maybe that's just, like, a dead-end way to think about it, because maybe there is just this, you know, this frontier, this existence beyond what we can even conceive of, and all we can think of is, like, medical body, brain, organic chemistry, biochemistry.
I have a very scientific, you know, engineering kind of background. That's really where I've spent a lot of my life. But there's something about science. If you try to apply science to, you know, religion, or if you try to apply science to, you know, the quest for meaning, it's not a useful tool for that. It's a useful tool for measuring quantities. But, the brain, they can analyze and say, yes, like you said, it's like, yes, well, this particular chemical has a particular receptacle, you know, in the...
But
you
it's
know,
just two different ways of looking at it, though. That's happening, and then there's something else happening.
Is there a physiological change that happens to the person that trips? Do they become more aware of other dimensionalities or other spirits? Or is it, like you said, is it unlocking some genetic code that's in our programming? Is it revealing information that we carry with us from our ancestors? Is it,
or is it
simply just some reaction in the brain?
Well,
it makes you think these things.
I want to disagree with you with the science and religion. I mean, although I haven't finished it yet, there's a professor on campus called Professor David Sloan Wilson, and he's leading in the field of evolutionary biology and evolutionary theory, and he's actually put out a few books, and one of them is called Unto Others, and it's about altruism, and then there, like, he also wrote something else, and like he's big on looking at like evolution of everything, not just like people as biological organisms, just like religion and how it's all it represents the same pattern, like what's going on down from like a molecular level, and then how organisms interact with one another, and like you can explain religion that way, and it's actually quite convincing.
Explain religion from a molecular level. That's very interesting.
Well, not from a molecular level, from, you know, animal behavior. But anyway, I'm taking a lot of evolution classes this semester, and I always like to read around the subject, and I've come across Terence McKenna, surprise, surprise, on evolution and time, really. And I think this is really important, so I'd like to read it. But this is extremely interesting. I mean, this is cognitive liberty right here. Okay, so this is from an interview on Coast to Coast, and this is Terence McKenna. His words, he said, "I created a vocabulary. Actually, I borrowed it from Alfred North Whitehead. But I think I'm on to something which science has missed, and it's this. It's that the universe, or human life, or an empire, or an ecosystem, any large-scale or small-scale process, can be looked at as a dynamic struggle between two qualities, which I call habit and novelty. And I think they're pretty self-explanatory. Habit is simply repetition of established patterns, conservation, holding back what has already been achieved into a system. And novelty is the chance-taking, the exploratory, the new, the never-before-seen. And these two qualities, habit and novelty, are locked in all situations in a kind of struggle. But the good news is that if you look at large scales of time, novelty is winning. And this is the point that I have been so concerned to make that I think science has overlooked. If you look back through the history of the human race, or life on this planet, or of the solar system and the galaxy, As you go backward in time, things become more simple, more basic. So turning that on its head, we can say that as you come towards the present, things become more novel, more complex. So I've taken this as a universal law, affecting historical processes, biological processes, and astrophysical processes. Nature produces and conserves novelty. And what I mean by that, as the universe cools, the original cloud of electron plasma, eventually atomic systems form. As it further cools, molecular systems, then long-chain polymers, then non-nucleated primitive DNA-containing life, later complex life, multicellular life, and this is a principle that reaches right up to our dear selves. And notice it's working across all scales of being. This is something that is true of human societies as it is of termite populations or populations of atoms in a chemical system. Nature conserves, prefers novelty, conserves and prefers novelty. And the interesting thing about an idea like this is that it stands the existentialism of modern philosophy on its head. You know, what modern atheistic existentialism says is that we're a cosmic accident and damn lucky to be here, and any meaning you get out of the situation, you're simply conferring. I say no. By looking deeply into the structure of nature, we can discover that novelty is what nature produces and conserves, and if that represents a universal value system, then the human world that we find today with our technologies and our complex societies represents the greatest novelty so far achieved, and suddenly you have a basis for an ethic. That which advances novelty is good. That which retards it is to be looked at very carefully.
Wow, cool. Novelty. Nature conserves and, what is it? Nature conserves?
And preserves
and
novelty.
Preserves novelty.
As opposed to habit. And that, you know, brings to mind for Jeff Capra, like we were just talking about, Tao of physics, like yin and yang in the universe. You need one over the other.
It also might be in opposition to the steady state theory of biological systems, you know. If you look at the evolutionary history, there are long periods of steady states where there are
Equilibrium, status quo.
Or that's, who's the biologist?
Gould?
Gould, Stephen Jay Gould. He talks about punctuated equilibrium, and that's when novelty is necessary, right? Because when there's some, you know, climactic change or, a change in the environment or whatever, that's when novel organisms might have the ability to adapt to the change.
This is a good quote from Terence McKenna. He says this later in the interview. So, for instance, the slow cooling out of the universe led to the slightly more rapid appearance of organic chemistry, which led to the quite rapid evolution of higher plants and animals, which led to the hysterical pace of human history. And I see no reason to suppose that this process of acceleration will ever slow down.
I think we are about out of time. It's hard to believe these 30 minutes just go by so quickly. Are you going to pursue this in for your academic? Is this what you're going to?
Yeah, I hope to.
Have you found people in the academic environment that you that have mentored
receptive.
You and receptive to this field? You have. Good.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, lots of leads, and this is great. If any kids are interested in doing this on campus, it's actually great because these professors. Like, they went to university in the 60s, 70s, so they're down. Anyway, research volunteers earn up to $700. Healthy male, female, club drug users, ages 18 to 55, needed for brain imaging scans. Live for 5 days on a research unit, the New York State Psychiatric Institute, Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. Go to maps.org for details if you're interested. $700, guys.
This has been Cognitive Liberty Airwaves here on WHRW. See you next week.